Welcome to the Dieter Mellhorn Fishing Podcast. Whether you like to fish, enjoy talking about fishing, or just enjoy the fishing lifestyle, this is the podcast for you. So go grab yourself a cold drink or a hot cup of coffee, sit back, start tying up some fishing rigs, and enjoy the show. Well, hello, folks, and welcome to the Dieter Mellhorn Fishing Podcast. I hope you're having a good day, whatever day it is that you happen to be listening to the show or watching the video version of the podcast on my YouTube channel. Either way, I appreciate you guys stopping by to check everything out on YouTube. You can always leave comments, suggestions, ideas down in the comment section. Podcast a little bit harder, so go to my website, DieterMellhornFishing.com. There's a link in the contact section on there where you can send me an email. Let me know what you think. Give me some ideas. Give me some feedback. I always appreciate hearing from you. And also on the website, there's links to the podcast, links to the YouTube channel, links to my guide service, links to the gear I use. Everything's on the website, DieterMellhornFishing.com. So go check that out if you're trying to get a hold of me. But today, we've got a pretty cool podcast with a captain, guide service operator down on the James River. His name is Captain Christian Moore, and I sat down with him at the 2022 Catfish Conference, which is a catfishing trade show, and we got to talk about his business. He's from North Carolina and made a move down to the eastern part of Virginia, where the James River is. For folks that are new to the catfish world, the James River is known for massive blue catfish. The catfish are not native to there, but they've kind of taken over, or at least really, really done a good job of establishing themselves there. And the area is known for big catfish. Lots of fish every year are caught in the 60 to 100 pound range there, and bigger. There are bigger ones, but it's really notorious for catching fish in that 60 to 90 pound range at a higher than average catch rate compared to other big fish fisheries. There's a lot of places where you can catch fish that size, or there are places where you can catch that fish that size. I'm not going to say a lot of them, but you can go to Wheeler, Santee Cooper, Mississippi River, Kerr Lake, you know, these places produce those fish. The James River, though, has a knack for producing a lot of fish in that size. Not that catching a fish over 50 pounds is a daily occurrence, but you've probably got a better chance there of catching a 50, 60, 70 pound fish than you do pretty much anywhere else in the country. We're going to sit down and talk with Captain Christian Moore about just that fishery and what it's about, why it's that way, what he loves about it, what you can expect if you decide to go there on down there on your own. It's a very insightful podcast. He's a very smart guy. He's kind of eat up with the catfish world like I am. And it was great to sit down and talk to him. And no matter where you fish in the country, I think you're going to enjoy what he has to say.
When did you start out fishing? Are you a latecomer to the fishing world, or you've been fishing all your life?
I've been fishing all my life. You know, my father got me into it when we were, you know, me and my brother when we were young kids fishing. We had a family farm pond, and then across the street from the church where we went to church, there was a couple ponds that we fished in all the time in the summer. Me and my brother stayed down there. The blue cat side of things, I didn't get into until 2005. I used to be an iron worker. One of my coworkers, it was springtime, he said, "Hey, you wanna go catfishing?" I'm like, "Yeah, I love to fish, let's go." So we went up to Danville, Virginia, you know, the headwaters of the Dan, and we put a little John boat in, and I wanted to bring, you know how we all are, you wanna bring your own fishing rod. I wanna bring my own stuff, so I show up with like a surf rod that I go to the beach with family, and it had like a little tandem rig on it with the little hooks and the duo locks. He said, "What are you gonna do with that?" I said, "We're fishing, man. I'm gonna show you what we're doing here." And so anyway, we get in the boat, we go up to the dam, he walks out on the catwalk, throws a cast net, casts some shad, and we head down river and fish on into the evening. I throw my rod out, and the very first fish that hit, I'm fighting it, and then he's gone. Pops off, reel my rig in. And the hook had pulled, it had opened that duo lock up. He's like, I told you about those things, they weren't gonna work. He's like, here, let me show you how to tie a rig. So tied a Carolina rig on, and we spent that evening catching some pretty good quality fish. I think the biggest one we caught was the mid 40s, several 20s, a few 30s, and I was hooked from then on. And then I was still very involved in work and stuff, so I didn't get to fish that much. About 5 years later, me and my dad, we bought our first boat. We got a pontoon and started fishing the Yadkin River area, High Rock, Baden, Tuckertown, and met a guy there, a good friend of mine now, Chris Hamill, and he kind of showed me the ropes, if you will, and how to target the species. And ever since then, man, I've just been wide open chasing them.
Now, you, back to when you were first fishing,
yeah,
little kid, I assume.
Uh-huh.
What was the blue cat population like then? Where did you grow up at? Where were you fishing at then?
I grew up in Summerfield, North Carolina. That's just north of Greensboro. I hadn't really done much. I had never catfished in a river, and the catfish that I had caught were channel cats out of farm ponds. So in terms of blue catfish population then, I couldn't tell you. But from what I've seen in 2005 till now, I would say it's had its ups and downs. I know the James River area and the tidal waters of Virginia, they say the heydays were, you know, 10 plus years ago. And I feel like just in fishing it very heavily for the last 5 years, it's increasingly coming back up. I feel like they have got some things in play on the commercial side of things that have, you know, kind of put some handcuffs on those guys where they can't keep the bigger fish, especially on the Rappahannock. I think it's a river that's really slept on. Not a lot of people know about it. I try to entice customers to come there. It's closer to my home. I enjoy fishing it, actually more than James.
Yeah. How did you go? Because for people that don't know, you're talking about the Yadkin River. That's kind of central North Carolina. It's east of Charlotte. How did you get from there all the way down to the...
To the James.
That's a good question.
Really good question. So my friend Chris, I was telling you about, we actually took a guided trip. Me, him, and my dad went up and fished with Captain Hugh Self several years ago. He's a legend.
Cigar in his mouth the whole time.
I always used to bring him. That's how I'd get on Hugh's good side. I'd bring him a cigar. And he liked these little cream-filled pastries from the grocery store. And we were like peas and carrots if you brought them in the mornings. But when I went out the first time with Hugh, with my father and Chris, I was like, you know, I love fishing. That's the first time I'd been up in the James River area. And we didn't kill the fish that day. We caught a few decent fish. But just watching the graph and the area we were fishing in and seeing how many catfish were in that river versus where I was used to fishing on the Yadkin or Kerr, I was like, you know what? I want to be a guide up here one day. And I told myself that then. Several years later, my wife's family is from Fredericksburg, Virginia. And we had started having kids, and my wife started getting, I don't want to say homesick, but, you know, she was far away from her family, and she realized being that far away after we had children was kind of tough. And she said, well, you know, one day we just started, well, what do you think about moving to Virginia? And I'm like, well, I don't think you'll have that hard of a time twisting my wrist to get me to Virginia.
Did you make it seem like she really accomplished something and let her have a victory?
Of course. You know, there was synergy there, you know, but for the most part, I was like, you know, obviously I miss being home. You know, I grew up small country, small town guy, lived close to my dad. That's been tough, but moving to Virginia and my passion, especially for the blue cat fishery, or just the fishery up there in general, has really allotted me the opportunity to start a business. I mean, it's definitely a fishery that you can sustain a charter business on. I mean, we all know the James River is world renowned for blue catfish. People come from all over the United States to fish it.
Now, for people that don't know the Jay Muir, don't know the title, because I take it for granted. I'm halfway close to the coast. I kind of understand the tidal world. I understand what that river is like. How does that compare to an inland river? And I'm not talking to Mississippi or Ohio, but like the Yadkin River, the Catawba River, the Tennessee River. Tell people the difference in the dynamic between, because those are really, they're rivers, but they really differ.
They are extremely different. And you use the word dynamic, and that's how I explain it to a lot of people. They're tidal, right? So in a 24-hour period, that current is going to change directions four times. It's going to go out, it's going to come back in. It's going to go out, and it's going to come back in. As anglers, and what I have learned studying it, what that gives you an opportunity to do is fish a lot of different patterns within a 12-hour period. You know, I have places that I enjoy fishing that are really good on incoming current, and I have places that I fish that are really good on outgoing current. There are areas of the river that are really good when the current is at its peak, and then there's areas that are really good when the current is starting to slack off and it's getting slow. So tidal water is just, from a targeting an apex predator, really gives you a lot of different choices if you learn them.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if somebody said, hey, I'm wanting to get in there and go fishing, I'd tell them to call you and go with you as a guide because you know what you're doing. But some people are going to want to go on their own and go, I'm going to go catch some fish down here.
Right.
What kind of challenges do you face when you do that on a place like the James River? What do you look at?
Weather's a big one. You really need to pay attention to your current direction, the incoming and the outgoing, versus the direction of what the wind's doing. Because a lot of times the river can get really nasty when it's done with bucking the tide, when the wind's going one way and the current's going the other. That can create some pretty big waters out there. And if you have a smaller craft, it can be really dangerous.
Yeah, and that's something that you probably get more of. I mean, you get stuff in, and we've all seen what can happen on Wheeler, big water like that, the right direction. But there, being near the coast, wind seems to exist a little more often than it does, you know.
Indeed, and it can change directions in the snap of a, snap of a hat. It's really wild. It's been something that, when I went to captain school, as well as you go through that portion of it, learning weather and how to read it and how to steer your boat when there's a specific type of weather condition and how to handle yourself. So that's helped tremendously. But I would say if you're a newcomer coming up there, get you a couple good weather apps, look at the direction of the wind and pay attention to which way the tide's going, and look at it on the map, right? Pull it up on your phone and watch the wind blowing across the water versus what the current's doing, and just kind of plan your trip. A lot of people will say, man, I know people have been catching good fish in this area of the river. I got to get here. Don't risk it. You know, they say that the old saying, risk it for the biscuit. Don't do that.
Yeah. Now, one of the other dynamics in that whole thing that's truly unique, I mean, there's very few fisheries for catfish anyway where you deal with this, is salinity. Mm-hmm. How does all that play? Where does it come in? Because, I mean, this goes from a little river up, I say relatively small, up around Richmond to a massive bay that it dumps into. Where does salinity play in, and what have you seen in that? And salinity, for people that don't know, that's the salt water from the ocean at some point is going to mix to a certain extent with the fresh water coming in. How does all that play?
So that's a good question. When I first moved there, knowing that was tidal water and it had salt in it, I really put a focus to it and tried, I got real nerdy with it, right? I got a salinity meter and I was taking salinity readings at different ends of the river from one end to the other, trying to log some stuff on a spreadsheet and put catch rates down on pen and paper and try. I never could come up with anything from it. I will tell you, one of the things I notice the most is when there's not a lot of rain in the watershed, that allows that salinity level to get higher up in the river. And in that, it allows a lot of the saltwater species to come up higher in the river. There's been times I've been fishing on the Rappahannock catfishing, and I've caught a stingray, I've caught a red drum. So that's a unique thing. You're not gonna find that back home on the Yadkin River.
Yeah. So floodwater plays a part in this, the influx of fresh water into.
Indeed, that is a big part.
How far, I mean, how salty, how much, And I know it's hard to define, but I mean, how far down can you catch these fish? Are you catching them down to where?
I personally have fished all the way below Williamsburg area, if you're familiar with that. Yeah, maybe 5-10 miles below Williamsburg, I've caught them.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah, catfish are tough. They can endure things a lot better than other species of fish. Their tolerance in terms of oxygen, they can thrive where there's lower oxygen levels than other things. They're a tough fish. They really are.
Because you're at the coast, you've got big commercial fishery there.
Mm-hmm.
For people that don't know, there's been some debate about the blue cat down there.
Indeed, yeah.
Take us through that history as far as what has happened and kind of how that whole evolution of how that came about.
The history of it, I probably can't tell you as best as some, but I know a lot of the, especially up in the Maryland area, they're very aggressive towards the blue catfish species because of the mussel beds, clams, crab. You know, they're eating our crab.
Because the blue cat is a non-native species.
That's right. I think Game and Inland Fisheries introduced, I think mid-80s. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's when Virginia, maybe late 70s, mid-80s, that's when they started putting them in the rivers up there. But and it's just not the shellfish, you know. They've been blamed for the striped bass decline, you know, all sorts of things. And I will say, you know, all these things that they're getting blamed on because this is tidal water, they're migratory species, and that, you know, the striped bass or the crab, during certain times of the year, they're going to push up in the river. Well, yes, the catfish are there. They're going to eat them if they're. Their menu changes, you know, it's like a buffet for them in that area. Yeah, they're going to eat them. But are they the true reason for the decline? I don't know. There's a lot of other things out in the bay, a lot of commercial fishing that generate bycatch and kill a lot of fish. I think that would be just as much to blame, if not more, than the blue catfish, because, I mean, we put them in there. They're natural predators, not found in those waters, but we put them in there. You can't, like, blame the species, per se.
And not to mention water quality, that's always a shifting sand too in most areas, especially near municipalities and everything like that. What do you know about there was a shocking program. Are they still doing that? I know they instituted a commercial shocking program.
That is correct. They did not do it this past year on the James, I do not believe, but me and some of the captains that rode up yesterday together. Chuck Jarvis, good friend of mine, he did say that they are going to be running two boats. I think there's two permits that are allowed per river. Don't quote me on that, but on the James, it's
And this
it's
is
two.
This is limited. It's not a widespread shocking deal. It's a limited deal, and they're harvesting them for, I guess, to go to market, or?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. Yep, to go to fish market, that's correct. I do know, Dieter, you might remember this, when I first moved there, there was a meeting with Game and Inland Fisheries, and I actually emailed you the meeting minutes for you to take a look at, and we actually got in play. You know, they're not supposed to keep them over 32 inches, the commercial guys. So, and that for anybody that's a trophy guy out there on the river that likes catching big fish, that's a win for us.
Yeah,
because you want those genetics kept in those waters. I mean, it's just like deer, better deer when you breed them, they're gonna, you know, their offspring are gonna create, you know, bigger bucks. And I think that's gonna be true to form with a catfish or any creature. That's just like us.
How much commercial fishing outside of the shocking takes place there? Is there a lot of it, or?
A lot of crabbers run up in the river.
But for catfish,
There's hoop netters. You've got hoop nets set on the river in locations. You'll see a buoy here and there, and that's a catfish pot, or what we call a hoop net.
Yeah.
You see those.
Are those fish sold to pay lakes for food?
After they remove them from our river, I have never done research myself to know what they do, but they're taking them to market. They're sold for food, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just curious about the dynamic there, because like you alluded to, I've heard people say there's been a decline from the peak, but what was the peak from what you've heard? I mean, what was the greatest?
I never got to, you know, the times I went up there and fished with Captain Hugh, it was decent fishing. But I've always heard, you know, my tournament partner, Dean Irwin, that I met up there, he's He's a well-rounded fisherman. He's lived in that area for 30 years. He's a multi-species guy. So he doesn't just do catfish. You know, you hear him and his buddies talk, you know, from mid-90s to 2008, 2009, in that era, they just said, I mean, you could go anywhere on the river and drop a piece of bait in the water and catch a 40, 50-pound fish. So I guess what I've heard them guys say is the commercial fishing's really hurt it, because I guess there for so long they were just slamming it with no regulations for so many years, it declined it.
Yeah. So I know there's always a balance. You got to hit a balance. You can't have, you know. Do you think the fishery has found its balance? Because you know you get places, you introduce a species, boom, it takes off because it's got. You know, it's like white perch coming into freshwater lakes. You know, they got all this threadfin and shit, and they just eat and kill everything.
Yeah.
But at some point, nature finds a balance.
That's what I was going to say, man. I mean, I'm not a biologist, obviously. I've done a lot of research and read a lot of college students' dissertations who were, you know, biology majors. Life always finds a way, right? Usually when something gets messed up in nature, it's our fault. You know, we do it. But I think eventually if it's left alone and it's just not commercial fish heavily, the catfish is going to be the thriving species. Because it's the apex predator there. It's going to be the dominant species. Will it hurt things? I don't want to say that. But I feel like the certain species that a lot of these groups are saying are on the decline because of the blue catfish, I don't buy it. I think those species, you know, they're going to bounce back. They'll find a way. Life always finds a way, especially in a river, to sustain, and everything starts, you know, getting some synergy to it, and everything's.
Yeah. And just for any of the people listening at home, we're taping this, like I said earlier, at the Catfish Conference. And while we have a nice, secluded place compared to what I normally have, there is a room next to us that you may hear some Skype conversations or something coming from. So that's what that noise is in the background, in case you hear it. What's the reality of fishing there? Because a lot of places, you know, you see the highlight reel, you see the best days. You go to a guide's page, you probably do it too. You don't put your little fish on there. You don't put your blank days on there. There's a reality in the middle, and I have it too. Listen, there, you know, we just came off one of the deadest, most difficult times of our year to fish a couple weeks ago. It was hideous, as bad as it is, like in June. But you have your great times too. What's the reality up there? Take us through the seasons as far as what you can expect, you know, and what the reality is, you know, kind of, you know, you're going to, from the low end to the high end. Well, start in January.
That's one of the things I love about tidal water, and not just January alone. I feel like you can catch fish, you really can, year-round, even if they're really spawning hard. I don't, when I see that water tipping into the 70s and low 70s, I leave them alone. I try not to target the big fish. I let them breed, do their thing. I try to give them a 4 to 6 weeks break, and then we'll get back into some post-spawn fish. But really, Dieter, the James River, it's an amazing place. I mean, of course, you're going to have your days where a huge front pushes in. You got some really mean lows or some highs that locks the fish up a little bit. But 9 times out of 10, even if those fish aren't actively feeding, you can set up somewhere on that river in a specific set or pattern and put a fish in the boat. And I'm not trying to blow my own horn. I can't remember a day where I've went and not boated a fish. It's been a long time. But it does happen. You know, it's fishing, right? You know, you're not always gonna slam, but there's definitely days that are better than some.
Yeah. What are your seasons like up there as far as, are there better months? I mean, is it?
My favorite is probably pre and post-spawn night fishing. You know, when the water temperature comes up, it seems like the fish just have a whole new level of strength, especially pre-spawn. You know, they're kind of weak post-spawn. They've been making babies and whatnot. But I feel like warmer waters get them really fired up. Night fishing in itself adds an extra level of excitement to it, because you lose your ability to kind of anticipate what the fish is doing unless you're running all kinds of fancy lights and stuff. But Really, in the same sense though, wintertime fishing's really good too. You know, they stage up in their wintering holes. They're a little bit easier to target, the bigger ones. They seem like they, instead of being so spread out and scattered, they're more congregated in areas. If you were, wintertime, I'll tell you like this, before I moved to Virginia, blue cat fishing, I used to always say fall and winter was my favorite time to catch them. Now I've kind of transitioned into a spring, summer guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I hear that from a lot of people. I mean, if you ever watch them, I'd be always thinking our inland waters that fall or early winter before it gets into the 40s, water temperature wise, is like primo time.
And it's good up there too, but I've had some really good nights on those rivers up there. Just, I think the best night I've had with big fish, I've caught 5 fish over 60 pounds in one evening. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Actually, now, do you have to, and everybody, I see a lot of big bait fishing up there. Is that to eliminate small fish? I mean, are there a lot of small fish too in that fishery? We hear about the big ones, but how many of the, I mean, is there a lot of small stuff up there too? Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there, you know, a lot of different areas will hold them more to none. I try just out of habit. And fishing there for so long, I usually tend to set up on where I know larger fish are, but you always get the occasional 5 to 10 pounder. You know, you'll accidentally sneak off, went to reel a rod in, and it'll have a little 2-pound blue cat on it. This has been down there drowned, and you're like, what are you doing, little guy? He's like, help me out. So they're there, especially on the Rappahannock. I would say it may not hurt that river to commercial fish it a little bit more, because it has in the 2 to 7, 8 pound class, you might walk on them, Dieter. There's so many in it. There's a lot of little small blue cats in the Rapp.
Now forgive my ignorance. Does the Rappahannock feed into the James, or is it a totally separate system?
It is a separate system. It's north of the James River. It actually feeds into the bay.
Is it easier to fish, harder to fish? Both from a technical standpoint and just the size of the river.
They fish very similar. I prefer going to the James in the fall and winter. And I feel like just because that's my comfort zone, that's where I've spent most of my time winter and fall fishing. But when springtime comes, summer, when people call me up, hey, I want to book a charter, I always say, hey, we need to go to the Rapp, because it's right there at my house. And when I first moved to Virginia, that's where I spent most of my time. And we moved in the, you know, before school started for the kids in that time. So that's where I was fishing, you know, summertime. And it's probably just as good on the Rapp in that fall, winter months. I just hadn't spent the time to learn the patterns. But they're there, caught good.
You may not know this. Was that area, was the Rappahannock stocked with blues, or did they get angler stocked with blues?
I do not know the answer to that. From what I have read, Game and Inland Fisheries put them in there as well.
Gotcha. Why do you think blues get so big down there? What is the magic combination of stuff?
The limitless supply of food. Those tidal rivers in our area are really easy to catch bait. They're full of gizzard shad. I mean, like, we all use different baits depending on what's running during the time of year. You know, we have a hickory run. White perch is a real big heavy hitter up there for fishing, but those fish have literally a buffet of things for them to eat. And I think, you know, from a biologist standpoint, I think they might tell you that salinity in the water may have something to do with it, the conditions, because it's probably some pretty healthy water for it, in that the going back and forth, that's going to highly oxygenate the water. I can probably tell you that would make a difference, for sure.
How do you catch bait down there?
I grew up throwing a cast net. They have what's called a gill net, which at first was a cumbersome pain in my behind when I first started running them.
Explain to people what a gill net is, for people that don't know what
sure,
that is.
Sure. A gill net, you have to buy a license for them. It's an annual fee. They have, I believe, it's 1 3/4 mesh on them is the legal size that we have to run for your gizzard shad. It's got a lower line and a top line. The top line has floats on it. The lower line is weighted. It's got a lead core. It's got little pieces of lead affixiated to it. And you store it in a tote or a bucket or a container or whatever, and you pay it out. You put it on the front of your boat and put it out. Fish swim into it. Then you retrieve it, pull the fish out. And sounds really easy, and it is now, but it was a pain in the butt at first. But it really makes getting bait easy.
Yeah. Now, do you put this thing out in the middle of a flowing river? Do you put it out at slack tide, or do you find some little oxbows and coves and pockets to pull
it in? Backwaters, creeks, there's barge pits up there you can put them in. You don't want to put them in moving water, because one thing that can happen is they can get full of fish, and then the current's going to take it away. And you've lost a $200 net, and you're like, shucks.
Wow, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Get that full. I mean, what else can you fish with? That may be intimidating for somebody who decides they're going to venture out on this place. I mean, does other stuff work? I ain't going to say chicken. We ain't going to get into that conversation today.
That's a catfish, man. Yeah. If it has an odor to it or it smells, it will strike their curiosity, I feel like. But, you know, I'm old school. I feel there's nothing better to use than what's naturally found in the waters that they're feeding in. You know, I try to match the hatch, if you will. You know, if you're going after an apex predator, you want to try to present them something that what they're eating in their natural waters. But I'm sure, you know, I've heard of people using chicken, or you could probably use dough baits or whatever they sell at the store. But I really don't feel like if you're targeting trophy size fish that you're gonna get one with some of that stuff. I feel like you want to use perch, shad. Eels is real big up there, freshwater eels. We use those sometimes.
Let's look at the guide side for a minute, because, you know, there's people, I get people that have never booked a guide trip before. It's somewhat intimidating to them. You don't know what to expect, what to do, any of that stuff. What is a guide trip like with you? How does it work? Take us through a day and tell us what that's going to be like.
Sure. So customer calls me. We set a date. A week prior before their trip, we get on the phone. We look at the weather, talk about what to wear, what you want to bring. If it's a day trip, we meet at the dock at 6:30. What a lot of them don't realize is I'm getting up at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I go catch fresh bait every morning before my trip, so I don't use bait from the previous days. Get on the boat, we go over some safety stuff. I let them know where the life jackets and all are, and then I always tell them, repeat after me, we will not need them. And, you know, we head out and fish some spots and keep eye on the weather throughout the day. And I always keep safety on, you know, as my main focus when I have people out on the boat. But, you know, I kind of try to get a feel for them. You know, we discuss when they book the charter, you know, have you been fishing before? Have you been catfishing? When we hook up on the first fish, if they need some coaching, I'm not shy. I'll help them out and let them know what they can do to make fighting that fish easier.
Because for people who have not fished in current, I assume y'all, depending on where you're at, a mile and a half, 2 mile an hour current there at the peak.
Yeah, I would say peak. You'll see it kissing 2.2, 2.3, up 2.5. When we get a lot of rain up there, the upper end of the river, man, I've bumped my boat into neutral and just let it drift, and my graph has told me I was moving 5.5-6 miles an hour.
Yeah. What is most people's reaction? Especially people who have never fished that type of tidal water when they hook into a fish.
Yeah, a lot of times they're like, I've got a giant fish on. This is incredible. I'm biting it, and they'll reel it in, and the fish is 20, 25 pounds, and they thought it was a monster. So it is to a lot of people who haven't fished current, it's a different ball game.
And to that point, that's really where the heavier tackle comes in, because I can go take people on a reservoir, we can drift, yep. We can fish with medium rods, we don't need big, huge pieces of weight, we're not chunking 16 ounces of weight. What is that tackle set up like out there on that kind of water? Because that's a different ball game.
When I started fishing up there, I was using 50 pound mono and 80 to 100 pound mono for my leader line. I've transitioned back a little bit. You know, that was just my initial, there's monsters up here, I need to be ready. Now I'm running 40 pound mono and 80 pound leader. I still keep the 80-pound. Because, you know, there's a lot of conditions. We fish a lot of structure. There's mussel beds. That stuff is hard on your line. I feel like everybody's always so fixated on what kind of reel you're using, rod. You need to keep an eye on your hooks and your leader. That's the part that meets that fish. That's really what you need to rely on to get him to the boat. That's touching him, right? That's what gets him on there.
Yeah. How much weight does it take in that current to keep these baits halfway close to the bottom?
Yeah, it depends.
Or do they need to be on the bottom?
It depends on how big a piece of bait you're wanting to run. You know, if you're on an outside rod and you're wanting to run a 2-3 inch chunk of gizzard shad, you gotta use a pound, 16 inch.
Really?
Yeah.
Really, that is crazy.
Yeah, because if you don't, all your rods are just going straight back behind the boat. Yeah. And when I fish, I like to. A lot of guys, they just throw them right out the back. In certain scenarios, if I'm fishing a big mud flat that's got current on it, I try to increase my percentages, right? I try to get those rods thrown out there to where I can get a good wide scent trail going back to attract the fish. So I think it's using a heavier weight is necessary for the way I do it, at least.
Now, are there any places, because those type of waters that I know were like South Carolina, Winyah Bay, those kind of places there, where do the fish hide in there? Where do they go to get out of the current to get the breaks? You know,
there's a lot of structure on these rivers. And not only structure will create current breaks, the natural way that the rivers bank and slope will create eddies underwater. We call them swirly holes. I tell you, if you're just getting into catfishing, one thing I would recommend is if you want to learn a body of water, pick a day to go out there and study it where there's zero wind. When there's zero wind, you can look at the surface of the water and kind of monitor how fast it's moving in specific areas. And that will really teach you what's below. You look at, you see maybe the river's running this way, and then 20, 30 feet away from it, it's going the other way. You're like, well, what the heck's going on over here? Go over and graph it and check out what's there. That's what I did a lot. There were days when I first moved here, I wouldn't even put a hook in the water. I would just ride around and try to find structure, breaks, natural areas that would funnel the fish to make it kind of like a traveling corridor. I feel like that's a big thing.
Yeah, because that's the thing a lot of people don't realize is it's not all water flowing through there flows the same speed, flows the same rate. And honestly, like you said, in the same direction. I mean, there are places with it can flow up back upstream.
Yeah, and it's when it's a windy day, you have to be pretty precise when you anchor on it, because if you get blowed off anchor, you know, you drift over into that water that's moving in another direction, you start doing this. You're spinning.
Yeah. Now, what happens, talking about the spinning, what happens at a tidal turn, because folks may not realize this, but the water goes one way for about 6 hours and then it turns around and goes the other way. What is that dynamic and what happens then with the fish? I mean, they're obviously used to it, but how do they react to it?
From what I've experienced thus far, on certain days when they're feeding really heavy, they'll feed up until the water's slacking up, and then even, you know, we've caught fish. We've forced ourselves to stay on anchor and caught fish to the point where the boat's about to turn around. But I think a lot of times what happens is if they're not really actively feeding, they're just hanging out in the current, just swimming, hanging tight. When the current lets up, it allows them a chance. They're going to pick up and move and get ready for that next switch. So a lot of times that's when we catch them, because they're just sitting there in the current, relaxing. When it slows up, they're getting ready for their next set, so they may move to another location where they're going to be in some protected waters that where the current's not as high, and that's when we'll catch them, when they're up moving.
Now, almost everybody I talk with, I've interviewed John Garland, he fishes down there. I've talked to Chris from Catfish, he fishes down there. Everybody's anchor. Does anybody try doing any bumping?
I'm not a bumper. I've bumped twice, but I pull boards up there, do a lot of drifting, do a lot of just long lining where I suspend baits and I'll drop the trolling motor down for boat control and just go on with the river. And I try that tactic a lot, especially when the fish aren't feeding very heavily. Maybe I can get more of a reaction bite from them, drifting a bait by them, hitting them in the head with it. So, and that just comes, you know, yakking guy, right? I grew up Yadkin River, Kerr Lake, pulling boards, dragging. It's a big part of the game in those areas.
Yeah. So when you're on a river trying to do that and you drop that trolling motor, are you dropping the motor and putting the bow into the current and using the motor to slow your drift back?
Yep.
And what's the, are you the typical half the speed of the current kind of deal?
It depends on how heavy the current, because one of the things that is really hard is weights, right? If you're fighting current, you got to get your bait size right. You got to know what if your bait is even within the realm of where the fish is hanging out. And if I feel like if you're pulling the baits too fast, they're just going to drift up. So I pull into the current primarily, and I use anywhere from a 3 to 4 or 5 ounce drifting weight.
Yeah. Now I can see somebody bottom bouncing, doing the bottom bouncing with trolling motor, but you said planer boards. That
ain't something that I do out there in the river channel and current. I do that more on the edges in the calm water, big mud flats and stuff, shallow water.
I was going to say, if you're able to float back in current with planer, that's a dynamic that would really be, because I can just see getting the exact amount of weight you need to keep it down.
You would have your hands full constantly. Because, yeah. You know, one thing, it's tidal. So when you start your drift, you might be in a mile and a half or mile per hour current, and then it peaks and you're up around 2, 2.5, and then it starts declining and you get back to a mile, mile and a half to half a mile. So you constantly have to be changing your setup, your weights. I don't have the patience for that.
Yeah, that would be a lot to juggle too with clients, I think.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you definitely wouldn't want to do it with customers on the boat.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. So, what's the future of your business? Are you gonna stay in the catfish niche? Or are you looking at expanding into striper, saltwater?
I hope to expand to other species. That's kind of why I selected the name Real Country Guide Service. I didn't want to lock into one species and associate the word catfish anywhere in the name of it. You know, that part of the country where I live, there's a lot of species. You know, I hope to one day start targeting the striped bass, as well as maybe do some crappy trips. And one of the things that I got turned on to a couple of years ago is cobia. I don't know if you've went cobia fishing. That is a very exciting creature to catch.
They're interesting because they can be almost like one of the dumbest fish in the world because they'll swim right up to the side of the boat and look at stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, when you...
I think that's their curiosity.
Yeah,
more than
but
anything.
When you're trying to find them, they're like horribly
elusive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Many of the trips I have gone cobia fishing with my partner, we've caught more sharks and rays and skates than anything. But, you know, I've had some good days out there, and those things pull like you wouldn't believe.
Now, when do cobia show up in that area?
I'm just getting into it. I'm not sure. You know, they start moving up in the bay in the springtime, and usually they start seeing them down in the, you know, the lower end of the James River, and then they move on up the bay and they get out in front of the other rivers.
Now, is that an area they're coming into to spawn?
I don't think the cobia come in the rivers. I think when they spawn, they're out on the sandbars and stuff out there, still in the bay.
Yeah, because I'm not...
And don't quote me on that. I hadn't mastered that species by no means, and I hadn't mastered catfish, but the cobia... is something that I'm now learning about, and from what I can tell, I do not think they come in the river. No.
Well, that is one of the things about that area that is really nice. It's got diversity in species, and you can get tired of fishing for saltwater stuff, and then you can go catch some giant fish, or vice versa. And that's a cool part about that part of the country down there.
Yeah, and you know, this business for me is something I would like to grow. If it presents an opportunity where I can afford a larger vessel and get some, because right now my G3, that's not something that I can take out there in the bay, because the bay can get really nasty. Yeah, you don't want to be out there in a 20-foot aluminum John boat.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's a super.
I've taken it out there, but you know, you got to pick your days.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, a deep V, you know, traditional glass boat or a deep V aluminum, they're gonna be a little bit safer ride for you.
Well, I'm gonna put links in the description. But the best way for people to get a hold of you, I know there's usually a good way to get a hold of a guide. And one trip always. Tip I always tell people on guides, Don't even try to call them in the middle of the day. Call them in the evening, because that's when everybody returns your phone calls.
I would say the best way to contact me is through the phone, a text. Pop me a text and say, hey, this is such and such. We're interested in going out on a trip. My number's 336-988-1394. Shoot me a text. I'm going to get back with you. And I'm not going to wait till that evening. If I got my hands full, as soon as I get my hands cleaned off and get set down, I'll call you.
Well, there you go, folks. Whether you go down there on your own or you decide to book Christian Moore as your guide on your next trip, one thing's for sure, you're going to learn a lot. You're going to learn a lot if you've never fished these kind of waters, and you're going to learn a lot if you get on the boat with him, because I'm telling you, the guy likes to talk about fishing. He likes to talk about catching fish, how he does it. He is one that will, if nothing else, give you a seminar on the water. And I'm going to try to get back down and tape some stuff with him, so hopefully I'll have some videos up here on YouTube. But I'm telling you, I think he's a very smart guy. He's a student of the game. And I thank you for trying to learn. I think he's a great one for you. If you're just trying to catch a big fish, I think he's a good one for you. So if you're looking to go fish down on the James River, I'm going to put some contact information down in the comment section on the YouTube channel and also on the podcast. And as always, if you guys can't find that, can't figure out where it's at, go to my website, send me a message, DieterMelhornFishing.com, send me a message. Hey, who's that big bearded guy that looks like a pirate that is down on the James River? I'll hook you up with him, and you guys can get out on the water. So, hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, we'll catch you out on the water.